Afternoon.
My name is Rod McInnes. I'm the director of the Lady Davis Institute at the U.S. General, and Mark Lathrop is the head of the Innovation and Genome Center here, and I coordinate this distinguished lecture series, and it gives me great pleasure as our second speaker. The first one was Tom Hudson a few weeks ago, who gave a wonderful lecture, and I absolutely know that you're going to enjoy this one as much. Our speaker is David Altshuler, who's an endocrinologist and human geneticist at Harvard, where he's a professor of genetics and medicine. And he's also in the Department of Molecular Biology and the Diabetes Unit at the Mass General. David has a remarkable history. He's one of the four founding members of the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT, which is one of the most amazing genetics research and genomics institutes in the world. And he serves as the Institute's first deputy director and the chief academic officer, which means he looks after all the stuff that isn't sort of like making sure the water runs. He's also a director of the Broad's program in medical and population geneticist, genetics being his main field. David's contributed, he's been a lead investigator in three of the major platforms that have been set up by genomicists around the world to facilitate the study of the human genome and its relationship to disease. And these include the SNP Consortium, the International HapMap, and the 1000 Genome Project. I won't tell you about David's research, you're going to hear about it. He's on a million advisory boards. I think most important of all these things is that he's a member of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies of Science. David.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and it's a real pleasure to be here today. I've had a wonderful dinner last night and then day meeting with some old friends and making some new friends, and I look forward to telling you about our work, and also I'll acknowledge in the 30 minutes before this, I modified the talk based on my discussion. So if you hear any themes that we talked about earlier in the day, that's your impact on my thinking. So I thought I'd start, I always start actually, with stating somewhat precisely the hypotheses that led me to this field and that animate a lot of my work. And I do this because I've discovered that human genetics is to some extent a Rorschach test, and different people come at it and they sort of interpret it in terms of their own drives and interests, and I thought I'd be explicit about what mine are. So after a short sojourn of 11 years as an MD, PhD, intern, resident, and fellow in internal medicine at Harvard and Mass General, I came to two conclusions, not quite as clearly articulated then as now. But one was the idea that what we didn't know about biology and about disease was substantial, that, you know, there were many gaps in our knowledge, and that specifically these gaps were likely relevant to the imperfect treatment that we were able to give our patients in the clinic. Now, I'll note that on some level, everyone agrees with these things. They're kind of mom and apple pie. But on the other hand, actually, it's not how most biomedical research is done. Most biomedical research is hypothesis-driven, which is based on the idea that the important biological processes and disease mechanisms have been identified, and that what we need to do is work on the ones that have already been found. And second of all, most drug development is done based on, as you'd expect, well-studied systems, the ones that we already know about. So one of the things that over time has come to really influence me and play a big role in my thinking is the following observation, which is that of compounds that enter phase one clinical trials, the percentage that emerge at the other end as FDA-approved drugs in America or clinically released compounds is estimated to be something like 2% now. This is actually a stunning number. This is almost, you could say, everything you need to know about the pharmaceutical industry. There's a lot of things that are discussed. We need to speed it up. Do we need regulatory reform? Do we need better this, that, and the other? What we need, one could argue, is therapeutic hypotheses that succeed more than 2% of the time. And it's also notable that this rate of success in clinical trials has fallen precipitously in the last 15 years. It was estimated in the period before that, which is somewhat of a golden age of the pharmaceutical industry, to have been something like 10 to 15%, the success rate, as opposed to 2%. It also used to be the case, I'm told, that failures used to be largely due to toxicity. And if you talk to people in the pharmaceutical industry now, it turns out most of the failures are due to efficacy, because people have gotten very good at squeezing predictive toxicology. So what this all sort of adds up to is the idea that, in fact, we actually don't yet have a good enough knowledge of biology and of the relevant factors to human disease to predict which compounds, all of which, by the way, cure a mouse, because you don't generally get into humans unless you've cured a mouse, that this is not sufficiently predictive. The other thing I'm a diabetologist by training, and the other thing that I just has informed my thinking, and it's again not how it's often talked about, so I thought I'd share it, is that I often hear that diabetes is a disease of lifestyle and that we know what to do. We just need to change our diet and exercise. And that's largely based on the Diabetes Prevention Program, which is a study that I've had the pleasure of collaborating with for the last 8 years. This is the 10-year follow-up of the landmark Diabetes Prevention Program. The results show that lifestyle modification is very statistically and significantly beneficial in delaying the onset of diabetes in at-risk individuals. It delays it all the way over 10 years from 50% to 40%. Now, I would say that that is far from a cure, far from a panacea, if it's the case that we don't have any interventions yet that can stop, let alone reverse, the progression of this disease. And I do believe, by the way, just to be clear, that a much more major lifestyle intervention or change in society might accomplish this in the way that smoking cessation programs affected tobacco. But I don't think it's the case. I feel confident it's not the case that the therapies and lifestyle changes we have to offer our patients today actually achieve good outcomes in the majority of patients with type 2 diabetes. So the approach that we and others have taken, obviously, is a very simple and straightforward one, which is to try and start with the patient and then ask the question, can we identify novel biological processes that play a role in human disease? And if so, can we make them useful in the long run for diagnosis and therapy? And in case you were under the impression that I was going to tell you that we'd already succeeded in getting all the way to the right, let me just give you, if you want to leave early, we have not succeeded in getting all the way to the right. There's a tremendous amount of work to be done. But I think that we have made some progress in at least the first step, which is to identify genes that play a role in the risk of diseases. Obviously, people before I came along did a spectacular job with single gene Mendelian disorders, and as I'll talk about, we've at least made some progress with common complex diseases. But it's fair to say that all of this is irrelevant unless we then can move on and understand what they can tell us about pathophysiology. There is generally no leaping from the identification of genes to diagnostics and therapeutics, although, again, in certain cases it can happen, but it's not the general rule. And I think it's also the case that if you want to understand the full genetics of the disease, you're going to have to understand pathophysiology, because while you can get your foot in the door, I think, in an unbiased genetic mapping kind of way, there has to be an interplay between understanding what those genes do to often find additional components with additional mutations. And I think that, again, in the general, if not in certain low-hanging fruit, all this is going to be needed to make progress. So if you've ever heard that what genomic scientists and geneticists say is that all we need to do is run our machines and then we will find the magic causes and they will cure everything, I am explicitly not saying that, so please don't suggest I ever said that, because I actually very much do not believe it's the case. So to be a little bit more precise before I get into more specific results, I had a discussion today at lunch with a number of colleagues, and it came up repeatedly throughout the day of how do we make progress from where we are with human genetics. And I think the real, a very important thing is to be precise as to what progress means to you. What do you actually want to do? But if what you want to do is inform therapeutics, then I think that what you're trying to do is help craft a therapeutic hypothesis. And to be more precise, a therapeutic hypothesis is the idea that if we perturb a target in a given manner, inhibit it or activate it, it will have a desired effect on some patient, and that it won't have at least on-target or off-target toxicity. Since it's a target hypothesis, it can't be off-target. That's a bad drug. But you at least would like to know that it wouldn't be that doing the exact thing you set out to do would actually damage the patient in some way. So what can human geneticists do to help with this? Well, we need to tell the gene, right? So it's not useful to have a locus. You need a gene. You need to know, do you want to inhibit that gene or do you want to activate that gene? Do you want a complete inhibition or do you want a partial inhibition? You'd like to understand dose response. Now, obviously, to really understand dose response, you're going to need some sort of exogenous agent. But an allelic series, for example, a null mutation or a hypomorphic allele or a gain-of-function allele, can give you a sense of how through the changing that activity will affect the patient. You'd like to have some biomarkers that you can use to actually measure target engagement so that you can understand when you go into the patient whether or not it's doing what you want it to do. And you'd actually like to understand if there are on-target toxicities, if there's a different mechanism of that, let's say, than what you're hoping to do. So this might be a package that, if delivered to pharmaceutical companies or the world, would actually be very useful. And one of the messages I'd like to convey is that although I think we're making progress in human genetics, and although there are examples of human genetic stories that meet these criteria, most of them don't, actually. Actually, it has nothing to do with effect size, per se. Often people are very enamored, sort of a, you know, how big my muscles are kind of thing. Is my gene Mendelian, or is it a small effect? But it's really not the relevant thing. The relevant thing, I think, to therapeutics is to understand, do you generate a therapeutic hypothesis, or if, again, if that's your goal, that is actually actionable in some way? And that's the measure we should hold ourselves to. So if this is the goal, if this is a goal, again, I want to be clear, I'm expressing my goals. I'm not saying what your goals should be. I'm just saying what my goals are. Then the question is, what role does human genetics play? And I think it has two particularly unique characteristics. One is, it is a method for discovery that is unbiased by previous hypotheses. So again, it can add new clues to the picture. And the other is, it's a method for obtaining causal inference in the human population. Now, there are many methods for discovery that's unbiased by prior hypotheses, and actually there are methods, you know, those can include things like screens in model systems, in flies or yeast or mice or whatever, or in cells. And similarly, there are methods for causal inference in human populations, like randomized clinical trials. But if you ask the question, how many methods are there that have both the property that you can do your discovery and make your choices in the human population and also derive causal inference, I think that human genetics stands out as at least a particularly desirable approach, at least for those aspects. So for the next few minutes, I'll first talk about just very briefly sort of how do we locate the genes that influence diabetes, which is our main area of focus in patients. And again, notice I use the word locate because in many cases that's as far as we've gotten. We've located them to a genomic region. So you all know, but again, it would be a sort of a misstatement not to make clear, that that there was a tremendous bottleneck in the identification of genes for human traits until 1980 or so, when the tools of recombinant DNA and being able to study DNA led to the understanding codified in this paper by David Botstein, but certainly was in the community, to use DNA polymorphism as genetic markers to make maps. And within 6 years, there was the first genetic map, and very soon thereafter, you see the rapid takeoff in the cloning of Mendelian disease genes, and everybody knows this. And one of the reasons I mention it, though, is to actually show that it actually took a fair bit of time, actually, to get from the concept to actually having the map to then identifying many of the genes. And actually, when we look back today in 2012, which is now 32 years, let's say, after that, or maybe depending on what you want to pick as the landmark, some decades later, there's a lot of revisionist history, actually. I have colleagues who sometimes say, well, in that Mendelian era, we just found the genes very quickly, we knew what they did, and we were able to move on to biology and therapeutics, and that hasn't happened in this recent era. And I think that's actually revisionist history. I think a fair bit of time went by. There were a lot of the time when people had linkages, they didn't know how to do positional cloning, or they'd actually found their gene, and they didn't know what it did. And there are still examples like Huntington's disease, where actually we've known the gene for 20 years, and exactly what function of that gene is the cause of that disease in patients remains actually quite challenging. But nonetheless, while these methods were highly successful for rare diseases, there was obviously a decade or so in which, if one were giving a talk about the genetics of complex disease, one would have been talking about family-based linkage studies, one would have been talking about isolated founder populations, one would have been talking about the positional cloning paradigm from linkage, but applied to complex diseases. And I think it's fair to say, and I don't feel like getting arrows shot at me, so I'll say there were very few successes of that approach. You can have a debate as to whether there were any successes of that approach for a complex genetic disease, but it's certainly not the case that there were many. And in fact, keeping an honest tally of which methods have worked and which methods haven't worked is an important thing for our field. There was a similar enthusiasm for candidate gene association studies. We all know that that was a very messy thing with many thousands of claims of success, which boiled down to a couple of dozen bona fide reproducible findings. And so with the sequencing of the human genome, there was an idea that if linkage studies didn't work, which placed bounds on the frequency and effect size of at least single loci contributing to these complex traits, and if we couldn't find the genes of interest by relying on prior biological knowledge to pluck them out of the genome, then essentially we would have to go to what would ultimately be a complete genetic variation comparison of people with and without diseases, selected in whatever way made sense. And the first version of that was actually to do common genetic variation, because you could sequence a modest number of people and then genotype those variants before you could sequence every one of those people. So it was a pragmatic solution. And there were reasons to think this might be successful, having to do with the fact that many of these diseases were late onset, And so it wasn't clear that there would be strong purifying selection against the alleles, as there is for childhood's early onset diseases, and also because of linkage disequilibrium, which had already been demonstrated, for example, in the cloning of cystic fibrosis, where the getting from the linkage to the gene actually involved recognizing the Delta 508 haplotype. So the idea that there would be founder alleles that could be used to map genes was one that was precedented. So I and many of my colleagues spent a decade or so at really following just on the Human Genome Project and using those methods to catalog and to characterize and then catalog human genetic variation, to develop laboratory tools that made it possible to measure this variation accurately in very large samples in an affordable way, and most importantly, and perhaps least obviously, to develop statistical methods that could reliably tell you where there were reproducible locus-specific associations to a given trait and not be fooled by technical artifacts or population mismatching or sort of statistical challenges, all of which you'll remember if you go back 5 years, were of great concern in the literature and all of which actually have turned out not to be difficult to overcome and manage to result in reproducible findings. So my own work focused on type 2 diabetes has really benefited from a 15-year partnership with Leif Group, my colleague with whom I work, Leif, who's Finnish by ancestry and works out of Malmo, Sweden, although very involved in research in Finland. And then over the last decade or so, Mike Behnke and Mark McCarthy and I basically had in the bar at many scientific meetings the discussion that none of us actually believed that our sample sizes would be large enough in these very complex diseases. And anyway, we liked each other and it would be a lot more fun to work together than to have an artificial competition just because that's how most human geneticists seem to like to behave. So we decided to collaborate together and basically now all of the work I do is in a full and seamless collaboration with all of these groups. So going into this sort of era when these tools started coming into play, there had been successful linkage studies to identify Mendelian disease genes that cause an early onset autosomal dominant form of type 2 diabetes called Modi diabetes, but really very little progress in the common form of the disease. And the application of these genome-wide association study methods has led now to today there being 54 reproducible associations of regions of the genome to risk of type 2 diabetes. All of these meet the standard that threshold of approximately 10 to the minus 8th for statistical significance, which seems to be predictive of future reproducibility, plus actually proving reproducible then subsequent to that in independent samples. And these associations were found largely by studies of type 2 diabetes in sort of a case control way, but some of them were found by studying other traits like glucose and obesity and the like, and then found to affect type 2 diabetes. You'll note that on my slide, it says, for the purposes of presentation, loci are named according to a nearby gene of interest. In only a few cases is the causal gene yet proven. This is because if we list in these things like a chromosome position in megabases, it's very difficult to look at, but some people have misunderstood that we're suggesting that we've identified the gene in each case, but we haven't, because for a number of reasons I'll describe, that's a difficult problem. The success in type 2 diabetes is, of course, not unique to type 2 diabetes. The current tally is something like 1,500 or 2,000. It's hard to keep track of. Bona fide associations, reproducible, locus-specific to each of some 250 different traits. And they range from cases where the results are actually the rare cases, I should say, where the results are fairly simple, like age-related macular degeneration with a handful of SNPs that explain 60% of the heritability and are all found in the complement pathway, or Dupuytren's contractor, one paper in New England Journal sort of showing quite big effects and a clustering pathway, to diseases such as psychiatric diseases and also blood pressure for reasons no one understands, where these methods have been much less successful. And it's sort of been very successful for autoimmune diseases and inflammatory diseases. And there's, I think, the answer for any genetic approach is it's going to be specific to the different disease based on both the underlying biology, the history of natural selection, how well you can measure the phenotype, yada, yada, yada. So there's no one answer. The diseases are all going to be different. But clearly this method, unlike, for example, family-based linkage studies for complex diseases in the decade before, has actually resulted in some bona fide and reproducible findings. So what do we find? We look across all these results for type 2 diabetes. Well, as I said, there's these reproducible findings. Each of them, as the effect of them in the population, as measured by the increment in risk for each allele of the tag SNP used to discover it, they're each modest in effect. From the largest, which is TCF7L2, found by deCODE, which has a 30 or 40% increased risk for allele, to the ones that have the smallest effects yet found, which of course is capped by the sample sizes, but of 10% or so increments in risk. If you like to know, one of the questions that often comes up is, are the results of these things relevant? Do they actually, these studies somehow put you in some strange corner of biology that's not worth knowing or one that we want to know about? Well, we find, of course, not surprisingly, overlap with the genes for the Mendelian form of diabetes. Genes that have rare mutations that affect diabetes often have common variants as well. That's universal across many diseases. And also overlap with previously utilized drug targets. But it's fair to say that the vast majority of these loci have no annotation of any gene in them that has previously been studied for diabetes. And this actually lack of overlap for type 2 diabetes to the genes studied by people who study diabetes has led to some mixture of consternation and rejection of these results by members of the diabetes community. We made a list of genes, 600 genes before we did our first genome-wide association study because we thought it would be genes that were mentioned in abstracts from the American Diabetes Association because we thought that would be a useful resource in interpreting our genome-wide association study results. And it turned out there was essentially no overlap between that list and the loci in which we found associations. And so this has led to some questioning. Again, are these results relevant? Well, it's interesting. If you look at other diseases, like in lipids, other traits, I should say, in lipids, when you do genome-wide association studies and you look at the overlap of the findings, the genes and the loci, for example, with Mendelian and drug targets, you find a great overlap. And then if you look at those that don't overlap with Mendelian genetics or drug targets, you find a large number of genes, not a majority, but a substantial number, that have previously identified roles in lipid biology. Why did this not happen with type 2 diabetes? Well, interestingly, if you just change the trait from type 2 diabetes to fasting glucose, and you do the genome-wide association study, which has been done by another consortium called the MAGIC Consortium, lots of individual groups that came together, what you find is a sort of similar overall picture in the sense that the fraction of the heritability explained, the effect sizes of the variants found for glucose levels are not that dissimilar from that for diabetes, but they're actually largely non-overlapping, although there are some overlaps. And the loci that are mapped for glucose levels, almost all of them contain a gene that was on the list of the 600 genes that was being studied in the American Diabetes Association prior to genome-wide association studies. So how do we interpret that? How can it be that when you do this method, it quote-unquote works in finding the genes that people were previously studying for fasting glucose, but doesn't work for type 2 diabetes? And I think actually it's not puzzling at all necessarily, because there's a difference between baseline homeostasis and pathophysiology of disease. In other words, there's one set of processes that regulates, for example, why glucose is in a normal range day to day. And there is another process that leads people to dysregulate their blood glucose and have it spiral out of control and they get type 2 diabetes. Now, it's possible that those two processes were the same, but it's not necessary that it be the case. If you think about, there are certain diseases that will be caused by growth or degeneration of a tissue. And it doesn't stand to reason that process of growth or degeneration or dysregulation is the same as day-to-day homeostasis. So my interpretation of this is actually that one way of thinking about it is that there were many, many studies, and if you think about it, it makes sense that this is what they would have been, that were studying the biology of glucose homeostasis. And they succeeded, both because it was evident that they succeeded, but also when you do human genetics for glucose levels, you actually find that there are genetic variations in those same genes that affect glucose levels. But when we do it for type 2 diabetes, we don't find those same genes for the most part. We find genes that have no annotation and have never been studied. And so it suggests to me, actually, that we did succeed in one of our goals, which was to identify novel genes that suggest there may be some pathophysiology of diabetes that we didn't know about. That is actually why I set out to do this work, because I thought that would be fun. But actually, when you identify, this is sort of one of the double-edged swords of genetics, and it's actually one of the things we don't talk about enough in our field, which is we all extol the virtues of discovery and finding novel things. But then actually what people kind of like to find often is that it's kind of novel but known enough about that you can rapidly order reagents from Sigma and get to work, or you can get the knockout mouse, or you can understand what's going on. And when you actually succeed in human genetics and identifying some, or yeast genetics or fly genetics or what have you, in discovering something that no one's ever studied before, you have a very difficult problem. Now, by the way, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It doesn't mean it's an unimportant problem. It just means it's a difficult problem. There are other things that make these results particularly difficult, not just for diabetes, but genome-wide association studies, difficult to follow up. One is that most of the variants variants with a T that contribute to trait variation appear to be non-coding. Now, that's to some extent an argument by exclusion because we don't actually know in most of the cases which variant is coding because there's linkage disequilibrium. But if you sequenced 1,000 people who of all the exons in all the regions that you are studying and you find no coding variants that could possibly explain it, it begins to argue that it's probably one of those non-coding variants you did find rather than an as yet missed coding variant. And then the other thing that I've realized, and I should have been smart enough to figure this out years ago, and probably many of you did in your own research, was that if you don't have a cellular model or an animal model that is faithfully recapitulating the biology of your disease, then if you succeed in your human genetic screen, it's extremely difficult to figure out what to do next because you need relevant cell and animal models of some variety to move forward. And in the case of diabetes, actually, there's no agreement in the field as to whether this is a disease of the beta cell, or of the fat cell, or of the liver cell, or of the muscle, or of the intestinal cells that secrete enterohepatic hormones, and these are just there's a lot of tissues, and so these are examples, not necessarily of these are not excuses. I'm just saying these are in following up these genes. These are the things we need to make progress. So sometimes I like to joke. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? That's an American joke, but anyway. So I figured you got it. So. I said it early on that like the first thing that would be useful would be simply to tell people what gene was relevant. And as I've said, we have loci, not genes from these studies. So how do we get to the genes? And it struck me a few years ago that although there is a very important decade of work to do in understanding all these non-coding variants to understand gene regulation so we can eventually understand that evidently important contribution to the genetics of disease, that the most direct path to getting to the gene would actually be what people have always done in positional cloning, which is sequence the exons of the genes in your region of linkage. After all, linkage disequilibrium is just a population form of linkage, just like linkage in a family. And then you say, can I find other mutations? Just as human geneticists have always said, there's nothing new under the sun. We need multiple alleles in the gene. Could we find other alleles of the same genes that would both tell us two things? One, which gene in the region is relevant? And two, what's the effect of a stronger perturbation than you find from the regulatory variant? And the thing that's made this practical to do in a more general way is the advent of next-generation sequencing. I'm going to skip this for the sake of time. And in fact, I do want to be clear, because of the story I'm about to tell you, that there are successes of this approach of asking, are there rare variants in GWAS loci that identify genes? And a very nice paper from Philippe Frogel and colleagues in diabetes for the melatonin receptor 1B finding that had been found by GWAS and finding rare variants in that just a couple of weeks ago. But there are other examples. Shomo Reshuteri had a beautiful paper from our community on a hugely penetrant mutation in CFH for age-related macular degeneration that happens to be the same mutation that had previously been found for hemolytic uremic syndrome, showing that that same allele could have different phenotypes and had been only partially understood based on ascertainment on hemolytic uremic syndrome, its effect in the population. So another example where our group did this, led by Sae Kathreeson, whose picture is there in the upper right, who has his own lab at Mass General at the Broad, was doing exome sequencing in a family with familial combined hypolipidemia. And as you'll remember, I told you that he and his colleagues had already done GWAS studies for lipids. And what they found, which was quite gratifying, was that this gene ANGPTL3, which I should be very clear, had previously been studied for lipid effects in mice, but was not known to affect LDL, was found to, through this exome sequencing approach, to have a rare variant that documented the effect on lipid fractions, and also moved this gene from one that had been identified by GWAS, but without any clarity as to what the causal gene was, into this category of both Mendelian and GWAS results because of the rare variants found in that exome sequencing study. And so we were I thought this was a potentially more direct path to getting at the gene, so we did a pretty obvious experiment, which was to sequence, to say we could take all the exons of all the genes in the regions that a few years ago when we designed this experiment with Tim Rolfe and David Cox at Pfizer, that we would sequence all the genes within 500 kilobases on either side of our GWAS hits because we didn't know quite how far away you could be. And we'd sequence them in a bunch of patients. And we'd do it, again, nothing creative here, sampling from the extremes of risk to maximize power. There's a very nice paper from Lin Gui and Ben Voigt led this in genetic epidemiology just about some power considerations in this kind of design for dichotomous traits. But the long and the short of it was, We identified with Leif Group and Ola Melander in Malmo a set of patients, a set of gene targets, first of all, which was about 2,800 exons from all the loci for diabetes and MI GWAS at that time. We also included as, they're not really controls, but the Mendelian genes for each of those traits. And then we sampled, again, which at the time was a large study, we thought, of 1,500 samples drawn from the extremes in a collection of 30,000 patients. And these are, just to give you a sense, cases of diabetes that were younger, age 47 on average, with lean, relatively lean BMI of 23, contrasted with controls who were euglycemic on an oral glucose tolerance test with an average age of 66 and an average age of average BMI of 33. So the idea was going out to the extremes and ask, could we find alleles of larger effect? And the long and the short of it is that having done a lot of work and a lot of analysis and solved a lot of technical problems, the result distribution, and actually I'm only showing you one test, but for the Cognoscenti, we've run every different kind of statistical test you can imagine. There is no excess above the null distribution, even in this set of enriched exomes and enriched exons and enriched patients for association to type 2 diabetes. By the way, we do see the common variants in this analysis because they are bona fide, and we see them again in these independent samples. We also, if you follow this field, you'll know that David Goldstein wrote a very impassioned argument that it might be the case that GWAS was often missing by a large margin. There were really rare variants that were driving these, and all we can say is we find no evidence whatsoever in diabetes or MI to support empirically this theoretical possibility. But one of the things that while that was somewhat disappointing, and again, I think that if we engage in bias, if we only show people the positive results, so I'm sharing results of things that we didn't work out because people may be thinking about doing them themselves or may have already done them and feel disappointed, and I want you to know you're not alone. But I think also that when we go back, or we actually knew this going forward, but it's worth reminding people that there are actually very few examples of rare variants that are known to play a role in common diseases. And the ones that are often cited are things like PCSK9 for LDL, or MC4 receptor in obesity, or Rick Lifton's rare variants in Mendelian genes in blood pressure. And in almost every one of these cases, when you actually look at the effect size and the frequency and what you'd need in terms of power, you actually need very large samples. So for example, even in the case of PCSK9, which is a fairly large effect and actually fairly common with a frequency of between 0.5% and 1%, depending on the population for these alleles, you actually need thousands and thousands of patients to get even modest levels of significance. So in Sake's replication, for example, which is a more unbiased estimator than the original discovery sample, in 1,500 cases of extreme early MI and 1,500 controls, you get, for this pretty large effect, 2.5-fold protection or 60% reduction of risk, you get something that would not be genome-wide significant if you had to sequence 20,000 genes and discover this de novo. So it actually shouldn't necessarily surprise us unless there were much larger effects to be found than the ones that actually were the basis for doing these kinds of studies. So this experience is, again, not universal. I showed a few slides ago the examples of people succeeding with this approach in a somewhat, in individual cases, but either there aren't going to be rare coding variants at these loci that we can use, or perhaps more likely, the sample sizes or sample selection or analysis need to be improved to recognize them. Of course, we found vast numbers of variants. We just weren't able to show that they were, in an unbiased and statistically rigorous way, enriched with the phenotype of interest as compared to people who didn't have the phenotype of interest. Note, by the way, that anyone tells you sequencing data without equally sequencing the controls, you should just ignore completely, because that's just storytelling. That has nothing to do with actual genetics. So two studies that have actually been ongoing, and again, it's the same cast of characters in different forms, different groupings, but that mean that we will, at least in the coming year or two, be able to answer this question for diabetes with much larger samples. One is a project we call Go Type 2 Diabetes, which is studying 2,800 individuals sampled to some extent. It's actually 1,000 of the individuals I showed you on the previous slide and some others sampled from of European ancestry, biased towards Finland, where the allelic architecture might be more restricted for intermediate and low-frequency variants. And these samples have been characterized, basically data generations finished, and processing and analysis are ongoing, with low-pass whole genome and high-coverage whole exome sequencing, which, if you want to talk about it, again, I don't like to spend that much time on the sort of technical details of these things, but to try and extract information. And this was a stimulus-funded and Wellcome Trust-funded effort. And then another study that is going on with colleagues from around the world and is a study called the Type 2 Diabetes Genes Consortium, which was funded by RFA from the NIDDK in America. And that study is sequencing now the design that we came to, two projects. 10,000 individuals are being exome sequenced, of which about 4,000 are done, and the rest will be done this year. And these are actually from five different ancestry groups. So there's 1,000 cases and 1,000 controls of European ancestry, of African-American ancestry, of Latino ancestry, of South Asian ancestry, and of East Asian ancestry. And then there's another project where 600 individuals from John Blangero's extensive large pedigrees in the San Antonio Family Heart Study and San Antonio Family Diabetes Study, which are very richly phenotyped, where we took pedigrees of average size 48 so that there would be no rare variants, private variants, because everything in a founder would be propagated through the pedigrees, and we've completed whole genome high coverage sequencing on those 1,000 people and are searching for relationships between low frequency variants and different traits. So my guess is that by the end of this year in type 2 diabetes, I think in large part because the community came together, first of all, there was historical collection of samples with very good phenotypes and from different populations, so that groundwork had been done, and because the field decided to work together in a very productive way, and then some funding was obtained, and it's all actually a lot of fun, and everyone's working together very well, that by the end of this year, we'll have something over 10 or 12,000 samples with different levels of genome sequencing that we can use to ask about the role of rare variants and see if we can actually identify low frequency or rare variants, in particular in the short run in coding regions that might be more interpretable, and see what their role is in diabetes. So I'm going to now sort of suggest that that we already have a number of clues, and I'm going to call them clues, of regions of the genome that do move risk of human diabetes. We have data collections ongoing that will, I think, hopefully identify more and refine the ones we have and give us more information. And the real question, I think, is, you know, coming back to this question of what would be useful to know, because it focuses the kind of follow-up and designs that we do, and I've gone through this slide, so I won't go through it again. So I think that a couple of just comments and datalets, but again, none of these are fully completed. This is not surprisingly, hopefully, a work in progress. But I think that many have recognized, and I have learned from them, that the most direct route, I think, to a therapeutic hypothesis for the general population are loss-of-function coding mutations that are protective against disease. Now, maybe in the question-answer period we can have a discussion about this. Some people think loss-of-function protective and loss-of-function risk are symmetrical, but I think they're definitely not. And the reason I would argue they're not is because when you have loss-of-function mutations, you can make an inference about taking away that function, but you can't make any inference about adding it back in someone who is replete for it. So when you see that there's a loss of function that increases risk, that does say that repleting it in someone who's missing it would be helpful, but it doesn't make any inference about people who lack those rare loss of function mutations. But when you see that people who lack function of a gene are protected, it makes the direct inference that if you could reduce activity of that in the population, it might help people in general. So we can argue about that if you want, but there's no doubt examples of this from the literature. So one example of this, this is actually the focus of much of our thinking, although we'll take whatever we can get, of course, but when we're asking, you know, Prester said chance favors the prepared mind, so this is what our minds are prepared to look for. And one example that I was telling Rob Slake about earlier is in the gene SLC38 that was identified in the first published genome-wide association study of type 2 diabetes that came from here and Philippe Frogel and colleagues. And in that study, one of the two reproducible findings was SLC38, a missense variant, in a zinc transporter that's expressed in the, that had been found a couple of years before this study, is expressed in the beta cell. And although there are papers about mouse knockouts, there's not really clear whether gain or loss of function. If you talk to people in the pharmaceutical industry about this potentially druggable target, one of the key questions is, do we want to activate it? Do we want to inhibit it? What exactly is going on? So in this study, one of the more interesting things we found, but I have to be clear that the statistical significance is insufficient to convince me that this is right, so we're getting more data, is we found a polymorphic stop codon in this gene. And the initial implication, since most people tend to think loss of function is bad, would be that this would be a risk factor. But interestingly, in 16,000 people we looked at, it actually was much less significant. nominally significantly less common in cases than in controls. And so we're taking this out into much larger samples to ask, for example, would this tell us just the simple fact that reducing rather than increasing the activity of this would be useful? Because there's already a biological function, and there's already, I think you could argue from Rob's work, very clear relationship, unambiguous relationship to diabetes risk, but this key fact of what direction you want to go, gain or loss, is actually critical to drug discovery. A second vignette I'll tell you is actually about using the results of human genetics to test a therapeutic hypothesis that actually didn't derive from human genetics, but where the human genetic perturbation can be useful. And here I'm going to talk about a paper that's actually in press at The Lancet that is about cholesterol. And we all know, of course, about bad cholesterol and good cholesterol, LDL and HDL cholesterol, and because the general relationships, although inverse, between LDL and HDL and heart attack are sort of similar magnitude, and because everyone has it measured, it's like 500 million tests a year in America measuring cholesterol values, we all tend to, if you read the newspapers, we all tend to be told you want to lower your bad cholesterol and you want to raise your good cholesterol. And in fact, we know without unambiguously, it seems to me, that LDL is clearly, if not the causal risk factor, at least as close to it that you can't separate them, because every genetic variation of which I'm aware that alters LDL has a predicted effect on MI, larger than predicted actually, and pharmacologic agents that perturb LDL, obviously, like the statins, benefit people with MI. So we're happy about that. But what about HDL? And the idea here, which is not our idea, of course, is of using Mendelian randomization, or using the idea that genetic variants that are distributed at random through meiosis, or at least through a randomization event in meiosis, can be used as perturbations to evaluate the causality of most directly, actually, that gene. But also, if you and there's a lot of debate about exactly how to do this that I'm not going to get into, but would be happy to discuss, for non-protein-based biomarkers. And here, this paper, which again is coming out in a couple of weeks in The Lancet, Ben Voigt and Seth Rasen, the first and last authors, a project they started when they were both in my lab. One thing they did, and there's a number of things in this paper, was when you do these Mendelian randomization studies, you would like it to be the case that the genetic perturbation you use to test the hypothesis is as pure as possible that one thing that you're measuring. So one thing that they identified was this, or not identified, but used as a variant, was this low-frequency variant in LipG, which raises HDL cholesterol. This is simply showing the magnitude of the increase in HDL cholesterol across four different cohorts that participated in this study. And then type that variant, which is about a 2% frequency, in 116,000 people for case and controls of MI, and to compare the effect of that perturbation in HDL based on the observational epidemiology to what was observed in patients. This was also done, I should say, but for the sake of time, not going through, with LDL variants, and all the LDL variants, without exception, had the predicted effect on MI. But this variant, for which there was extraordinary power, because of the 116,000 individuals from a worldwide consortium to do this, showed an odds ratio of just exactly 1. All right, so there was no relationship between this perturbation in HDL, which both has something to say, certainly about perturbing this drug potential drug target in exactly this way, which would affect HDL, but wouldn't affect MI, at least based on this experiment, this analysis, and might say something about HDL more generally, but of course it's only one variable. So the other thing that they did was they used a score of SNPs that affect LDL and HDL, derived from the worldwide Global Lipids Consortium that's identified 100 loci in the genome that affect HDL, LDL, triglycerides, or some combination, and they extracted from that those that more purely affected LDL or HDL, which was a subset, and then they put those into these very large samples. And you can see here, for example, with the LDL cholesterol, the way this is reported is the odds, first on the left column, is the odds ratio for each standard deviation increase in either LDL or HDL based on the observational epidemiology in these studies. Okay, so that just tells you that for every standard deviation of increase in the LDL, you should see a 1.5-fold effect on MI risk based on the observational epidemiology. And then on the right column is for a score of common genetic variants derived from GWAS that perturb LDL by one standard deviation, what's the observed effect on MI? And the answer is 2.13, in other words, larger than 1.54. And some people like to think maybe that suggests there's something else going on, but it's actually, I think, regression dilution, or basically that you don't measure, the LDL is actually not such a great measure of the LDL right? Because if you measure LDL on Tuesday and come back on Wednesday, there's variability, whereas the genetic variant is actually more of a lifetime exposure. So there's a theory to understand it. It turns out that increase is just about what you expect from the day-to-day variability in LDL. And of course, the significance of that is whatever, 10^-10. So now you do the same thing with HDL, and you say, here is the expected for every one standard deviation increase in HDL from this combination of 12 different mechanisms, because the 12 different SNPs, you expect a 40% reduction in MI risk. And the observation is at best a 7% reduction, and the p-value is 0.63 in 100,000 people or whatever. So these data, I'm going to speak carefully, fail to provide support for the hypothesis that any change in HDL will be associated with a benefit in MI risk, which certain people will say, of course, that's obvious. Why would you ever think that? Now, first of all, for LDL, I think it is safe to say that almost any reduction in LDL, we have pretty strong evidence that many, if not all, reductions in LDL will benefit MI risk, so it's not symmetrical. But it is worth noting, although I'm not drawing a direct comparison, that there are two very large and very expensive drug trials that were recently stopped in the last few years, one for torcetrabib, which acts through CATB by Pfizer, which is something like $1 billion was spent developing, which raised HDL to a large extent and ended up increasing mortality. Now, people like to sometimes point out that that there was also a small increment in blood pressure and that it was a dirty drug, although that small increment in blood pressure quantitatively would be completely swamped by the massive increase in HDL, but maybe that's not a good example. There's also the niacin trial that was recently stopped that had big effects on HDL. So even though some people say, well, we would never think this, there are, in fact, very expensive drug trials ongoing, and there continue to be drug trials that are expensive ongoing on the HDL-raising hypothesis, and at least these data fail to provide support for that hypothesis that it will always work. It may work in some cases, of course. So the last thing I will say, I've talked about two ways to get from human genetics potentially to something useful, at least for therapeutics. One is these loss-of-function protective mutations that you can then take forward. A second is just using the human genetic variation to test a hypothesis that already exists in the way I described with HDL. But if you want to actually, if those low-hanging fruit don't work, there's no doubt that we're going to need to understand deeply, and it's going to take a long time, the biology of these genes. And here I think what's key is the creation of cell and animal models in which you can study these things, because without those it's very difficult to take the genetic mapping result forward. And I'll give one example, just because the work of my colleague Romnik Xavier, because such an elegant example, I had nothing to do with this, but it's a much better example than I've been able to come up with, so I hope that Romnik doesn't mind, so hopefully you won't mind either. And this follows the really very successful work in Crohn's disease, using genome-wide association studies to identify genes. But one particular, ATG16L1, which was one of the prismatic gene variant discoveries from GWAS that identified autophagy as playing a role in this disease. And so one very interesting thing that they did was in this paper in Nature a few years ago with that Romnik was a collaborator on, they identified a particular histologic finding in patients who carried the variants in ATG16L1, and that's these larger red blobs on the right as compared to the left. And then the question was this phenotype something that you could study in a mouse? And remarkably, and it really is remarkable, and sorry I didn't fix the animation, is that when they went on with Skip Virgin and they made a mouse knock-in, first a knockout and then a knock-in of this variant in the mouse, they actually find the same pathology in the Paneth cells of the mouse with this variant as they do in the humans with this variant. And personally, I would feel more comfortable if I was studying a mouse model of a human phenotype that is sort of both connected by genotype and phenotype, than something that I don't know has a correlate in the human, both pathology and genetics. And so this kind of thing, which is really making isogenic cell and animal lines that carry human disease mutations and then seeking the phenotype that you study in them, is a valuable complement, I think, to sort of a model system forward approach than looking for the human phenotype. I think both are valuable, but I think that we have to be careful not, for example, to start with a missense variant or a gain of function or something and then make a knockout and assume that's a model, because often complete loss of function may not be what we're dealing with. Our own efforts in this regard really are just two collaborations that are somewhat far along. One is a collaboration with George Daly. We published a paper in Cell a few months ago now on a very interesting pathway or call it what you will, regulatory system of LIN-28 and LET-7 that George was studying for cancer and stem cell biology and that first came out of genome-wide association studies for height. And then it turned into a very interesting story about height and also glucose metabolism with an overlap of the mouse phenotypes and the human genetic phenotypes. And another, a collaboration with Joe Averuch in his lab at MGH that we are just writing up now about a mouse model of one of the first genes that we found in our genome-wide association studies of diabetes, a gene called IMP2, where we found striking similarities in the mouse phenotype and the human phenotype of making this model. So those are just, clearly longer stories because we have to go and understand them, but clearly if we're not committed to that, we're not going to get where we need to go. So just in the last 2 or 3 minutes, I'll just give a couple of thoughts. Almost every meeting I had, people talked about, wanted to talk together about where do we go from here, and obviously I don't really know the answer, but I'll give you my perspective, which is that, first of all, as I said, we have to be careful in stating clearly and precisely what we think human genetics is useful for. And in the realm of complex common diseases, which is, again, what I'm focused on, I think that human genetics is most powerful as a tool to develop and test hypotheses about human biology. And note I didn't say personalized predictive medicine, which I just think is less clearly useful in these diseases, given the genetic architecture and also the nature of the problems, but there, of course, will be successes. I think that human genetics has been a field which, depending on whether you want to say it's been decades or you could say a century, has been really focused on the recognition that there were genetic components to these diseases and gated by our inability to find them and to identify them. And it's really only in the last 20 years or so that we've made first, we as a community, again, I didn't contribute to it, made remarkable success with Mendelian diseases, and now we're making the first progress in complex diseases. And I think that when we think about the fact that in the coming years, there will just in this year alone, there will be, for example, 1 million individuals genotyped for something that's being loosely called the exome chip, which is a microarray that contains all of the non-synonymous variants found in 12,000 exome sequences, so down to quite low frequencies. And the genome sequencing is becoming cheap enough that it will likely be done in very large numbers of individuals. That the approach, that the bottleneck of identifying genes is, you could either argue, soon to be, or perhaps already has become not the rate-limiting step. And in fact, one thing we were talking about in our meeting earlier is how interesting and different it would have been if when Rob Sladek identified SLC38, if that had been the only gene variant found for type 2 diabetes, there'd probably be more people working on it now than having found 50 others. Because in fact, one of the things I hear all the time is, I don't know which one to work on, I can only work on one at a time, what should I do? You know, and the answer, so it's a sort of striking thing that one would be better than many, when you'd think that actually having a more complete picture would be better for the scientific process. And so I think that we need to think, again, clearly about what are the steps we need to take to get from this kind of discovery to something useful to patients. And, if you think about it, the kind of discovery research we're talking about, which is done in genetics but not limited to genetics, is really just identifying components that might play a role, or do play a role, I should say, at least in the case of genetics, some role, otherwise unspecified, in the etiology of the disease. So how do we get to the other side? I think we've been too loose at times in sort of saying how we get to the other side of something useful. And I guess one thing that I'd like to say, in part because it came up in all the meetings, but also because I've been thinking about it a lot over the last year or two, is that we as a community of human geneticists for complex traits, certainly, and again, I'm only point the finger at ourselves, have really failed, I think, at a critically important thing, which is to organize, interpret, and communicate all the information we're finding in a way that actually is interpretable to the much larger community of biologists and people who work in pharmaceutical companies. And what I mean by that is that as I have more and more conversations with people in these settings, they often say, you know, if I work on a gene, and you human geneticists, it would be really nice if you could tell me, is there any phenotype in humans associated with that gene? And I'd like to have a place I can go where I can answer that. And the fact is that having, as a community, done genome-wide association studies in something like 1 million people, and now exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing going on, you know, gangbusters and exome chips, and, you know, you just imagine this going forward, we have to answer that question. And similarly, they'd like to say, for those who are less wedded to prior hypotheses, for a disease of interest, can you tell me the genes that do play a role, at least based on human genetic variation, in that disease? And we have not provided that. the best kinds of thing we have for at least these recent era is like the NHGRI website where you can go and just find a distillation of papers. There's nothing that's much richer than that. It reminds me a little bit of the era of the internet, because I'm a geek and a technophile, and it reminds me of the era. I was into the internet before, I mean, I didn't do anything about it, but I'd play on it, but before there was Google. It used to be you couldn't find anything you wanted. People would tell you how useful it was going to be, but you'd go in and you'd type, you know, a pizza place near me that's really good and people like, and you'd get like a pizza place in Cleveland, and you'd get, you know, something totally unrelated. But then Google came along and others, and now, you know, it's amazing, right? That you're, you know, if I wanted to find, you know, my way anywhere, my iPhone can lead me. But if you wanted to ask the question, our community's vast investment in understanding the relationship between genotype and phenotype in humans, how do you actually map and understand that? And the answer is we have not done a good job. And I think it's not a technical problem, actually. I think it's an organizational and a incentive and a sociological problem more than a technical problem. It was a regulatory problem as well. So even if we had those hypotheses, I don't think that sort of mapping, I don't think it's going to be useful in the general sense in the long run unless we understand the mechanisms, unless we generate the cell and animal models that others can use, because we have a lot of we have a lot of people who will pick something up if there's a cell or animal model or a reagent, but aren't necessarily committed enough to make it themselves, and then to at least understand these therapeutic hypotheses better, all, I think, of which must be done prior to anybody actually developing a therapeutic. So I actually don't think the idea, you know, of like of pharmaceutical companies just looking at a list of human genetic results and developing a therapeutic is a good idea. We should provide them something much richer than that if they're going to actually develop therapies. And I think that, again, the challenge here is that the community of biologists is generally uninterested in all the stuff that geneticists do. And this is maybe because they don't think it's relevant, or maybe because it's hard, or maybe because they've heard that it didn't work, or whatever it is. But the empirical observation is that there are strikingly few people. And for example, at NIDDK, where I was on the advisory council, they have a substantial investment in human genetics, and they have a massive, much, much larger, like 20 times larger, investment in cell and animal models, and they're completely disjoint. There's almost no one who's doing both, and you can blame the human geneticists for not picking up the tools of biology, but you can also mention that the biologists are completely uninterested, for the most part, in the human genetics results because they're already satisfied that the models and cells they're studying are the right ones. So I think that we have a lot of work to do as a community if we're actually going to make good on this, and there's no guarantee we will. But I'm an optimistic man, and so I think that, in fact, we will, but it will take us understanding better what the real problems are and being motivated to fix them. And with this, the last point I'll make, and then I'll stop, is that I've heard a lot and read a lot the idea that you know, 5 years into the era of making some progress with the genetics of complex traits, we can declare it a failure because where are the therapies and we don't understand everything. And so I just made this slide when I was giving a talk with Joe Goldstein at a symposium in Sweden recently, or a year ago, which is, how long did it take to do cholesterol? Because, you know, did that happen very quickly? And, of course, it should be noted that there are actually 3 Nobel Prizes in the history of cholesterol going back 100 years. And it was first recognized that cholesterol was in the plaques 100 years ago. FH was in the 1920s, I believe. The association by Framingham to MI was in the 60s. It was in the 70s that the molecular biology was worked out. And then the 80s, you know, the development of the statins and the trials came out in the early 90s. And then it took another 10 years for it to become routine. So while I don't think that means we should slow down and say, give us a century and come back and we'll just scratch our heads, I do think, on the other hand, it would be a little unreasonable to declare the human genetics forward approach a failure when it's so early in the era, but how we go forward is certainly not entirely clear. So with that, I'll just stop. I've tried to point out some of my collaborators and colleagues as I went along, and if there's time, I'll be happy to take any questions.
So while people are thinking, my main concern is the fact that we can no longer justify wine in the evening because it's raising our HDL, and that's bogus.
My understanding of the observational epidemiology is that red wine drinking is associated with better outcomes, but with much of observational epidemiology, I worry a lot about confounding by socioeconomic status, since, of course, we didn't randomize people to red wine versus beer versus other things. But regardless, it was a very nice bottle of red wine last night you served. So. Any questions or comments, disagreements?
Red wine is good for memory.
Yes, red wine's good for memory, too. Yes. Come on. Yes.
I noticed your comment in the New York Times yesterday.
Yes.
Article,
yes.
Where he examined 53,000 monozygotic twins.
Yes.
And he came up with basically no real association in 24 particular
Sure. So first let me comment on what Bert Vogelstein's paper does and doesn't say. So the question was about a paper that came out in Science Translational Medicine yesterday, and there's an article in the New York Times today that I happen to be quoted in, but there's a lot of articles about it. So first of all, let's be clear as to what Bert Vogelstein and his son and other colleagues did in this paper, which was they basically said, we can use studies of monozygotic twins to ask the question, when one person has an identical gene, if you have a genotype, what's the penetrance, if you will, of that genotype? And then you can build a model of if you were to sequence people and sort of know all that information, how predictive would it be? And there are some technical issues, or not technical, there's some data issues with the paper, which is that they didn't specify the follow-up of the individuals, and it's critical, actually. Many of their twin concordances are lower than many others in the literature, but I don't think it changes the general result, which is obviously right, and all geneticists have known for a very long time, which is that identical twins are not 100% concordant for traits. So there's one way of, so what they did then was a mathematical model to say if you had the everyone in this room, and you sequence their genome, and you use the sort of identical twin concordance to say if you could identify that genotype, how predictive would it be? And what they come to the conclusion is it wouldn't be fully predictive. And what I said to people who asked me about this is, that's actually the first thing, they asked me, were you surprised by this, or you know, should we have done the Human Genome Project? And I just said that as someone who's interested in complex trait genetics, actually the first thing I did in this field before entering it was read about the twin studies, and it was obvious and apparent that monozygotic twins are not identical, and I've always assumed that that was the case, which is why I never talk about personalized medicine. Because when you know that the identical twin concordance for type 1 diabetes is 30%, then it says even if you had that identical genotype, it wouldn't be fully penetrant. So why is it that people think that if you sequence genomes, you're going to end up bifurcating the population into two groups, one of whom is absolutely determined to get the disease and one not? And that's because, I hate to say it, the Mendelian fallacy and the fact that we've had decades of Mendelian geneticists, both in model systems and in humans, talk about the unusual case in terms of the general trait variation of the population, where the trait is extraordinarily unlikely in the general population. And when you have a specific genotype, now it's extremely likely. And so you basically have a bifurcation into those who do get the disease and those who don't. And the public, between that and learning about Mendel's P's in grade school, come away thinking that when they hear genetics and the idea of inheritance, that that means Mendelian and highly predictive. And there are leaders of the scientific community who have actually pushed the idea that sequencing genomes for complex traits will be predictive. But I think that I agreed with the analysis in the paper, although I think in detail, you know, exactly how predictive or not you can pick at it. It's pretty obvious that it's not that, you know, identical twins always don't have the same outcome, and so it's not going to be the case that any amount of sequencing will fully predict. Having said that, I've never found prediction very interesting, to be honest with you. And as a physician who took care of patients for 10 years, I never found that when patients walked in and wanted to talk about heart attack, what they wanted you to do was pull out the Framingham risk score, give them a precise risk estimator, and then tell them to go on their way. What they wanted to hear about was what could you do for them. And I think that as I tried to build the case over the last hour, hopefully with some clarity, is that what's really holding us back in many diseases is we don't have any drugs or very limited drugs that are actually efficacious, and that I think of human genetics maybe in the same way a yeast geneticist or a worm geneticist or a fly geneticist is, which is a way to open up the biology in the hope, as yet unproven, that knowing more biology will allow us to develop drugs and other preventions that actually work, not because I want to predict what's going to happen. But Mendelian genetics has been for a long time largely about prediction, so that community of medical geneticists, of which I am not one, tend to think that a lot of it is about reading genomes and making predictions. Not all, but there are people in that community who think that way.
Why are you looking at me?
I'm not. I'm just making sure you don't hit me.
Yeah.
Yes. They want you to use the microphone. If yes, I can repeat the question.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead just for time, and I'll repeat it. No, it's okay. Go ahead. Yes.
And this huge trial on HDL.
Yes.
It didn't work and it's whatever.
Yes.
So why not also look at the successes within those trials?
Yes.
Make sure that there is a bunch, I don't know, 5, 10, or whatever percent that actually actually managed. Thank
yes.
you. That managed to respond.
Yes.
And look what made them respond.
So there's two models here, and of course, in some that both models will be relevant in places, but they really are based on very different hypotheses. So one hypothesis, what you're saying is, the question was, if trials fail, one possibility is that they fail because there are some responders and some non-responders, although if the trial fails, there's kind of equal numbers of
no,
both.
No, what I'm saying is that if you put a drug across the board
yes.
saying that cancer is cancer and you have many,
yep.
even within a given cancer, you
yep.
have many subgroups, your likelihood of having an efficiency
yes.
decreases drastically.
So what you're saying is, so there's a model which will in some cases be correct, but not in others, which is that the drug actually works, it just works in a subset of people. That's one model. The other model is the drug is actually on a mechanism that wouldn't help anyone on the planet. It would do great in a cell or animal model of a particular mutant type, but there are no people like that. And so we can't disentangle those. And so one approach you're saying is to try and subdivide the population. This is the sort of personalized medicine mantra that we need to do is figure out in whom to give our drugs, which I just like to point out, suggests that they would work in someone. And I guess I do believe that. They would work in someone who had the same biology as whatever model system was used to pick that drug. But it doesn't mean there's any person like that.
There are many hypotheses, you know.
Yes,
for
that's what I said. There's...
Absolutely, but yes. maybe start by kind of provide better subgrouping. I work on cancer,
yes.
and in some type of cancer, just
agreed.
By knowing what are the things,
yeah.
you could potentially better target them. You could even use all drugs in a good combination and achieve 80 to 90% cure.
If it's the case, if it's the case in whatever disease you're working on, that there are drugs that would
but
work.
People consider disease as a one. This
no,
is
no,
what
no
I'm...
Oh, I didn't say that. No, I agree with you. I'm just saying. There's subdivide. There's a model underlying what you're saying that in some cases will be accurate, but I don't think we should assert as a truth, which is that the reason things are failing is because they're heterogeneous and we have not subdivided them enough. That's a model. Another model is they're actually homogeneous and we're just on the wrong mechanism. We just don't know which is which. That's one thing we're doing, but we're also doing them. So I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but I'm saying just as you're correct that if we had ways to subdivide the patients, which, for example, in cancer based on mutational spectra you have, if there's a meaningful way to divide the patients, for example, with diabetes, I think that's, or with HDL cholesterol or what have you, that might be a good thing to do. But we also, again, I just want to also point out that in addition to what you're saying, which is correct, it's also the fact that the drug you're trying just might not be useful at all. And we shouldn't assume it is, because often there's no data in humans to suggest it is in the first place. And so it's not just subdividing, it's also getting something that actually will work.
It's getting late. I think we
okay.
better call it a day.
Okay.
I want to thank you for a really incredibly nuanced and thoughtful talk.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.